And children are the best. Children are the absolute best because they haven't had all of the primate civilized out of them yet. So they touch everything and they want to put stuff in their mouth and they speak too loud and they run too fast. And it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing to watch. You know, you can watch a kid's mind be blown every single day downstairs because they're seeing a real sized giraffe or a dinosaur or a blue whale. And the adults too, you know, they hide it better. But the awe is, I think it's something really shared.
Hey everybody, welcome to This Anthro Life. As always, this is Adam Gamwell. Today we're speaking with Andrea Iller. She's a postdoc at the Smithsonian National Museum for Natural History. She is an evolutionary biologist and a biological anthropologist. She's doing some amazing work that's looking at how primates and humans adapt to environments over time or don't, and how differences in environment will affect the ways that we develop. And so this is an important conversation that digs into questions of evolution, that digs into notions of humanity, and also environmental stress and how we are both part of our environment as well as ways that we change it. So it's an important conversation for, you know, anthropologists, for lay public in general. And so that's part of our thinking here is we want to know, what is the role of museums? What is the role of the Smithsonian and science museums in bringing people together and sharing science, sharing scientific knowledge? And that's kind of what Andrea is acknowledging in the opening quote there, that awe is a part of this, and a part of museum work, and that really gets us drawn in. So this is a really special conversation that I'm excited to share. We got to record this when I was down in D.C. working on our other new mini-series that's with the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage. And so we're really excited to bring you all this great content that we were able to record while on location in D.C., and we are excited to bring out this first episode to you. So we hope you enjoy the conversation with Andrea Iller. Andrea, thank you for joining us on the program, or joining me, I guess.
Thanks for having me.
And opening up your office and get to see all these cool skeletons and animals and jars and things.
Yeah. You know, I like to keep it colorful, you know.
And it quite is, yeah. And so you're a biologist and a biological anthropologist. Mm-hmm. And so tell the good people in a kind of a framework of what it is that you do. And like also, a lot of people, you know, they know I'm a cultural anthropologist, Ryan's an archaeologist. We don't really have too many bios, and it's awesome that we get to talk. So tell us a bit about what that framework is.
Yeah. So I guess the easiest way is I study primates. And primates, as you probably know, include monkeys and apes, lots of different, even the lemurs, little striped-tailed guys that you see.
Super cute.
Yeah, I know, right? But it also includes humans. And so it's a very interesting group of biological organisms, right? So because of that, to study them properly, you have to have a good dose of anthropology, right? Whether you're studying the humans or the lemurs, you kind of have to have an idea of how these, you know, complicated, very intelligent animals work. But then you also need a good dose of biology, you know, just some sort of basics about vertebrates, mammalian evolution. And so biological anthropology as a field covers people who work on human evolution, primates, comparative anatomy, things that sort of comparative genomics, things like that, that sort of cover the sweep of this whole group of animals. So because of that, in the museum, I sort of have a place between the anthro department and the mammals department, which is part of the vertebrate zoology department. Yeah.
Did you, when you were kind of picking up your studies, did you ultimately, like, you know, sort of initially right away gravitate towards doing biology or biological anthropology, or was it sort of this, you know, you had the four field approach that a lot of people do, and then you like kind of honed in?
The second one.
Right, that's good. That's good. Kind of a wide spectrum that you can choose.
Yeah, absolutely. So as an undergrad, I actually was a sociology major and had a healthy dose of cultural anthro as well. I was really into that stuff, and I actually went to graduate school for sociology. Yeah.
Dangerous.
I know, dangerous, right? So close. Although I really enjoyed the way that both of those fields helped me to think critically about my social world. The part that I really didn't understand and I guess got frustrated about was the fact that the body seemed not to be a part of it. That we talked a lot about, you know, the different sort of cultural norms and mores that we have, oppression, entitlement, and yet all of this seemed to be happening in creatures that had no body, or a body that was ultimately just another cultural expression. And, you know, I'm not a determinist. I don't think that biology is the end-all be-all of what makes you who you are, but it seems like we are this great compromise between the two. And so that's when I got interested. You know, I really was like, I want to understand this body without having to give up my understanding of the social world. And biological anthropology was sort of this weird group of kids. Let me do that.
That's super cool to think with. And it's funny, I mean, ironically, to think about the human selves as the great compromise between culture and biology. But perhaps that is an accurate way of thinking about it.
I mean, there's lots of... you know, when you look back in the human fossil record, it doesn't take, you actually can go quite a ways back and you see humans changing their environment. And they're not just changing their environment. You know, when they do that, and when they do that totally, they change their bodies too. And some of those changes are only things that survive in that individual's lifetime, but other changes, things that are passed on culturally, sometimes things that are passed on genetically, do change subsequent generations of humans. And we have been altering our own bodies and our own environment for a very long time. And so, I do think that we're, you know, I guess all animals are in a certain way, but it's really our culture that most of them are living under, not vice versa.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm trying to think, like, an example could simply be the kinds of foods that you might choose to eat, you know, over time as you develop, like, you know, we have morphology in our teeth would change or something, right?
That's a perfect example. And that you can get, you know, real disgust, you know, if people grow up eating an American diet, for example, they will have a real and visceral disgust response to bugs, let's say.
Right?
Even though it's a sustainable and diversible protein source, humans throughout time and all over the world have eaten insects. I'm holding up this book, Edible Insects and Human Evolution, written by a friend of mine, Julie Lesnick. But it's a real physiological response. You know, if you grow up not having that as sort of part of your wheelhouse, much like learning a language or learning how to walk or ride a bike a certain way, you have a way of sort of consecrating that knowledge in yourself. It's harder to break those things out than you might think, or perhaps just as hard. Diet is an excellent example of sort of a place where, you know, we all have to eat, right? And we all have roughly the same nutritional requirements. So how do we accomplish that? Well, lots of different ways.
Yeah, that's totally right. I'm gonna totally actually ask a left field thought that just came to my head.
Let's go.
That was actually, it's based on a couple different things that popped into my head, but the fact that you said that, like, we see over time there's a response that you'll see in this case, the kind of teeth or bone structure change.
Sure.
This is a general weird meta question, but, like, you know, a lot of mindfulness studies, you know, people that do meditation and things like that, they may talk about part of mindfulness, like, it can both literally change your mind in this case. And actually, Michael Pollan's new book, How to Change Your Mind, is about psychedelics and doing it that way. But this notion of, like, sort of response change over time. I'm thinking about this with the different word of reaction. And, like, normally it says, like, when people are not really aware of the world, they react to things versus respond to it. And so a lot of mindfulness training is actually about how do you respond to something. And so it's, you have me thinking in terms of, we're looking, thinking evolutionarily over time, like, evolution only responds. It doesn't react to things. And I'm trying to think of, like, that's like, it's almost like it's like mindfulness training in itself. I don't know. This is totally weird.
No, I mean, I see your point. And I think one of the things that makes evolution an interesting but challenging, you know, when I tell people that I study evolution, people assume that I'm studying the past. Evolution is still happening. It's still a thing. And the fact that a cultural presence has changed the pressures that we are under doesn't change the fact that we are under environmental pressures. And as you just said, a biological organism is a responsive unit. That is what a living thing does that non-living things don't do. We react, we respond, we acclimate, we adapt. And the differences in those words is largely a time scale. You know, a reaction may be something that happens, like you were saying, when you were, you know, blindsided, right? Something comes that you weren't anticipating that it was going to be a part of your world. Well, you have, you know, a flight or fight mechanism, for example, for something to react to that. But let's say that you are, you know, responding to an ongoing pressure like sunlight or racism. Well, those are going to create different physiological responses because the pressure is long-term and it may not be lethal directly. It may not result in a fight or flight response, But the attenuations between those systems are complex. And yeah. and so evolutionary studies, a lot of biological anthropology studies those processes as they're happening in modern animals so that we can better understand the past.
Yeah, and that's actually super interesting because you think about two people's stress responses, right? Like, and over time you might see like the effect of chronic stress in somebody over years will then lead to maybe a degenerative disease that like could be in their gene code but wouldn't necessarily be expressed if it was just kind of like tomorrow, but then suddenly over years it's like same stress will then sort of like cause these genes to perhaps flip on in such a way. And so it's a really great, it's a good illustration you have there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Certainly there's a colleague I can think of, Lance Gravely. He's out of the University of Florida, but he's done work, you know, the medical community, for example, in the United States has long sort of published the knowledge that Black Americans are more likely to have heart disease, cardiovascular, diabetes, type 2, various chronic illnesses that threaten a lot of Western civilizations. Well, you know, Gravely's work and a lot of others makes a good strong argument that, just as you were saying, it is tempting to see as though it is an inherited thing, something innate to Blackness. Mm. It is not. And we know this certainly because Black folks who don't live in the United States don't have these same yeah. issues. It actually makes a lot more sense that some of these chronic illnesses are the result of chronic stress. And that chronic stress is then related to various other socioeconomic factors, which are directly related with being a Black American relative to a couple of other factors, of yeah. course, education and income level and things like that. But it's a different way of seeing it because I think that it's important that we think of the bodies as our bodies as responsive. In a more personal way, that's something that really drives my work. I mean, I'm interested in understanding, like I said, the past, our evolutionary history, but I want people to understand more about how your body is responding to what you're doing to it right now yeah. and the kind of things it is better at doing and the kind of things that it has to work harder to achieve. You know, our minds can sometimes be very disconnected from those things, you know? Yeah, as I'm sure you know if you work on meditation, mindfulness.
Right on. And that, but I think that's a beautiful thought to kind of build on there, because I know, so as we mentioned in the intro, that you're doing your postdoc here at the Smithsonian, which we can call the name is hard to say for me, right? National Museum of Natural History, the NMNH.
There you go.
And so we'll say that for now on, because that's easier.
No, you got it.
You know, but so you're doing some awesome postdoc work here now. And, you know, I also want to kind of talk a bit about what that is and then think about, you know, another piece of conversation that we can build in that you said, actually, when you said the phrase of like actually thinking about, you know, the sort of the body's response and adaptiveness to stress over time, you phrase that as learning to see something a different way. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, you mentioned to me before too, some of your work is about helping the public see science a different way, right? It's about yeah. seeing primates, our adaptive responses, but in general, like how do we bring science, and in this case, evolution, we talked a bit about too, but like, you know, whatever the subject is, like it's about helping the public and ourselves see ourselves mm-hmm. in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I really do. I guess my sort of big thing is that I want people to appreciate our part of the natural world, that I think that lots of times, what we're responsible for in terms of the environmental impacts of our culture and population. Yes, some of it is necessity, but I think a lot of it is this sort of false idea that we are masters of the planet as opposed to being participants of it. And I find that to be an unhealthy view, basically, yeah. from the personal all the way up to, you know, the super political, I suppose. Because it's false. And, you know, you can be as much of a badass as you want and you still have to eat and you still have to breathe.
That's true.
And it's pretty actually easy. It's easier than a lot of us want to consider, that those things are stoppable and yeah. that they're, you know, our great empires can't change that. Now that idea is not something I necessarily get across to every member of the public.
Just so you know, we all have to eat, right?
Yeah, indeed. Just so you're aware. You know, but we try to come at that same lesson, but from a couple of different angles, you know, yeah. so that you can kind of pick it up from different ways. So my postdoc work. So the name of the project is called the Emphasis Project, and that's an acronym, and it stands for, and I'll only do this once, it's all you'll need, Environmental Mismatch in Primates and Humans, Anthropogenic Settings and Impacts Survey. Emphasis.
Very short title.
I know, right, exactly. Yeah. It's very succinct. Emphasis. it's the acronym to remember. That, yeah. Yes, indeed, indeed. Okay, what does that mean? So basically what that means is I am very interested in the environments that animals came from. And in a place like the Smithsonian, we have very large collections of animals that came from all places around the world. And so in primates, for example, we have animals that were shot in the wild 100 or more years ago. We have animals that were in biomedical facilities in the 50s and 60s before the animal ethics laws that exist today. We have animals that are from zoos in the last decade. Each one of these settings would have posed particular pressures on their environment. Now, here's the real clincher. So it sounds like really cool, and you're like, oh, okay, so I would like to know the differences. Like, what is it like to grow up in a zoo versus what is it like to grow up in the wild? You know, the wild sounds lovely, but you don't have medical care, and you don't have protection from predators. But in the zoo, you might be exposed to more microbes than you were before, or in fact, you might be exposed to less. And that might create an interesting response in your immune system. So we're looking at these kind of effects in parallel with human populations. So in humans, we well know that as we as a group move from agricultural and more nomadic living to things that are, well, I guess from nomadic to agricultural and then to things that are more urban-centered, things where we're more densely packed and more permanently located, you get health outcomes that are switching. We have more parasites, more earlier lifespans, I guess, dying younger, having more injury that we weren't able to fix. This was back in the day. When you get into cities, you get things like infectious diseases and chronic diseases. Later on comes cancers, but certainly sedentary diseases, obesity, and things related to that, as we have up to today. So that's kind of an angle that we're starting on, is sort of looking at these wild captive animals. But one of the things that I'm guessing that the public doesn't necessarily know is that when researchers, people like me, who come into this museum and they want to study gorillas, let's say, they usually don't study the ones in the zoo because they think that they're messed up. And you get them off the record, and they'll all tell you that.
Wow.
I exclude captive animals because they're not normal, and we don't know why, so I'll just... I heard that for the first time when I was a grad student, and I thought, well, that's odd.
That doesn't sound right.
Right? I mean, going back to that whole, if biology is a responsive life thing, well, you change the environment, but not the life, and you'd think that that would be interesting and worth study. It is. But that's a perspective change, and one that's happening right now. As far as I know, we intend to survey all 8,000 of the primates. So that's all living taxa globally that exist in this collection. Some of them, I'm not splitting.